Y'all ready for this?
She was beautiful. She was young. She was innocent. She was the greatest piece of ass I've ever had, and I've had them all over the world.
You're hot. Very hot.
Well, I've got news for you. You are mine now. You belong to me.
It's time for the coolest segment on the internet. Turned On with Tina Peake from Crusher Magazine.
Y'all ready for this?
Abso-fucking-lutely.
Tonight, we're going to do things a little differently. My good friend, Robbie Razor Rob Fogel, of the heavy metal band called Metal Knights, spelt K-N-I-G-H-T-S, joins me for a two-part special presentation, with tonight being part one. It's a fairly in-depth interview, something I don't normally do for my radio segment, but my producer was kind enough to give me some free rein on this one because Razor is a pretty interesting guy and really the coolest dude you could imagine. He's been through a lot, and tonight we'll be talking about his near-death experiences, and I will also be featuring two songs off the Metal Knights' brand spanking new CD titled World of Forever, which hasn't even been released yet. The first song I'll be introducing to you is called Till Death Do We Meet Again, Miracle in Disguise, and features Razor's daughter, 10-year-old Valerie, the little Razorette, who had to endure watching her father slowly fading away and almost dying before her eyes. The Enforcer, which will be the first single off Metal Knights' World of Forever, will be played at the end of the segment. I hope you enjoy the interview, and don't forget to tune in next week to Turned On with Tina at the same time for part two, where Razor and I will be talking more about the band Metal Knights, the music, the writing, and recording with the help of Craig Goldie of Dio, who also happened to produce the album. So grab a coffee or a soda, light up a doobie, chill, because here we go, part one of my interview with Razor of Metal Knights.
All right, well, I've got a lot of questions to ask you.
Okay, let's go for it. I'm ready.
All right, cool, because not only are you a very inspiring person, but also incredibly talented on many levels, so I really wanted to get into a lot of different areas of your life and different things.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, cool. So let's go back just a bit. In 1995, you were diagnosed with a chronic form of hepatitis C, and by 2001, you were literally knocking on death's door before finally receiving a liver transplant from an organ donor in April of 2005. Can you share a little bit about that time of your life? And what or who was your inspiration through that difficult time?
Well, yeah, it was the toughest thing I've ever gone through, needless to say. And I would say the biggest inspiration was my wife and my daughter. They stood by me, and even when, you know, we didn't think I was going to live, my daughter was always, every morning, every day, would come in and sit on the bed with me. You got to remember, for the last year prior to my transplant, I was completely bedridden. I couldn't get out of bed. All my muscles had atrophied. I couldn't walk. My wife had to literally spoon feed me, clean up after me, take care of me, bathe me in bed. And my daughter was always there, and she was only about 5 at the time, but so strong. And she would come in and, you know, Daddy, you're going to make it. You're going to get your transplant. You know, it's going to be okay. And she truly believed it. And my wife was the same way, and she had to go through literally hell to take care of me for those years. And from 95 till about 2001, things were okay, but in 2001 I started to get to the point where I couldn't work anymore, I couldn't do anything anymore, I couldn't be creative anymore. All I could do was basically wait to die, and they were just such big inspirations to me on a personal level. On other levels, music was a huge inspiration and kept me going. I used to listen to some of my favorite artists, and I have to, I always go back to, there's this one song by Rob Halford that he did when he was out of Judas Priest, when he had the band Halford, called Silent Screams. And when he would do that song, when I would sit there and listen to that song, it was like he wrote that song for me, because everything that he was saying is what was going on in my life. Here I was laying in bed. I could barely talk. I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink. Even keeping water down was hard. And waiting for them to give me the okay, saying that, you know, I was indeed going to get on the transplant list, and then have to wait through all that process to actually hit the lottery and you know, become number one on the list. And I used to listen to that song over and over and over, and it used to just speak to me when the lyrics of that song would say that I'm screaming inside and nobody's hearing me. Those were the things, you know, that I was going through. So there were many different things and people and inspirations that kept me going. And but on a personal level, my wife and daughter, but music also played a huge role,
right,
in keeping me going and giving me the inspiration to hang on, because you have to put yourself in a mindset that you're going to make it,
right,
even when you really don't know if you are. I was, for some reason, I just never gave up.
All doctors to the ER. All doctors to the ER.
Daddy, Daddy, don't go, Daddy. I need you. You can do this and you can be strong. Just hang in there, Daddy. But if God wants to take you, then I know you will be with the angels. And I know till death do we meet again.
Thank you.
this all just some sort of dream? Someone gave it a life and now I'll come back from. Rebirth is complete, I'm back.
I'm free.
I'm alive. I survived.
Yeah.
You know, about a hero in your life. My wife is my hero.
Right on.
So,
Razor, can I ask you something more personal? I'm not sure if you've been asked this before. I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find any information. How did you catch Hep C? Because I know there's a variety of ways that you can get it, and I was just wondering if you wanted to share that.
Yeah, I was actually in a head-on car collision in 1984 here in Orange County, California, and somebody had ran a light and came directly straight into the car I was in, and at the time I was with an old girlfriend, and we got crushed, I mean, horrendously. I thought I was going to die in that thing. My chest got crushed by the steering wheel. You know, they didn't have airbags then in the car that I was in, and it was a very, very vicious head-on collision, and they ended up giving me blood transfusions, and I was fine after that. You know, I recovered. I went on with my life, and I went in for a routine physical, as I did every year, but it wasn't until the one in 95 that they said, you know what, we think we made a mistake on your blood test, why don't you come back, we have to redo it. I was like, okay, you know, maybe, you know, my cholesterol was too high. I didn't know what it meant. So I go back in, and they redid my test, and I got a call about a week later, and they said, you have to come in for consultation about your blood test. And this is right when the whole AIDS thing was really taking off, and I was like, oh, God, don't tell me I have AIDS. And, nobody knew about hepatitis C. And when they told me that it was non-A, non-B, that kind of made it sound like it was okay, because it was a non.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right. No, I hear that.
Yeah, so I was like, well, I know what hepatitis A and hepatitis B are, and if these are nons, then I guess I'm going to be okay, right? And they go, well, we don't really know. I go, well, then just give me a shot. You give people shots for A and D. Why can't you just give me a shot? They're like, well, no, it's something new, and we're still discovering it. And it was about 6 months, 7 months later, they contacted me, and they said, you need to come back in. We got to talk to you. We've discovered out what you have. And I went in, and that's when they basically gave me the death sentence. You know, they sent me to a liver specialist, and that was the guy that basically said, you know, you got 15 years, if you're lucky. And, you know, he wasn't far off. I had 10, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, like you said, there are several other ways, and since I've kind of become this advocate for trying to spread the word about hepatitis C and working with the Taun Mastery Foundation and Donate Life and all these other organizations that do really good work and trying to help people, I have found out that, you know, it can be spread in all sorts of ways, through drug abuse and through tattooing,
right.
Ear piercings or body piercings. There's all sorts of ways that it can be spread. It can even be spread through the use of a razor from somebody who's been infected, toothbrushes, and so many people have it. Did you know more people have hepatitis C floating around that don't even know it than have the HIV virus? So that's kind of one of the things that I think I'm still here on this planet for. I think I'm still around to try to, you know, help out in some way. And if this is the way, then, you know, I'm willing to do it.
Right. And I was going to ask you actually about your involvement with Donate Life America, and you're also a key contributor, as you said, to Donate Life Rocks. This month in April happens to be National Donate Life Month, and I wondered if you could tell our listeners basically about both projects and what we can all do to help make a difference, especially with donor awareness, et cetera.
Sure. Well, Donate Life America is a great organization that actually goes out and spreads, gets people to be aware that there's a shortage of organs in the organ pool, and we need more people to sign up. And, you know, by signing the back of your driver's license or putting that little sticker on your driver's license and saying that in the case something tragic happens to you, that you're willing to help save somebody else's life. And that's their main goal. They don't go out to do it for money. They don't go out to do it for any other reason, but then to help spread the word and get people to sign up. And Donate Life Rocks came about as kind of a subsidiary of Donate Life America because of a great musician by the name of Alex Band. And Alex had somebody in his family that was almost needed a transplant, and the hell that it puts you through when you have a loved one going through this situation, it really touched him and it changed him. And you know, Alex Band was in, he was in The Calling. He's a very famous band, and he's now doing solo work, and he became, you know, it became Alex Band's Donate Life Rocks. And through that, I, you know, through just when I heard about Donate Life Rocks, I sent them a message online saying, you know, wow, this is great. I'm a, for number one, I'm a musician. I'm in a rock band, and I've had a transplant, and you guys have now this whole thing, Donate Life Rocks. I think this is great, a great way to get the word out and try to help people. And it was about 5 minutes after I sent that email, I got a phone call from the head of the organization saying, you know, holy cow, we got to, you know, we need to hook up and talk. And a year, about a year went by where nothing happened in my life except I went through struggling to get better after the transplant. And then when I did get better, all of a sudden this whole thing with Donate Life Rocks came about, and I got asked to be a part of it. And it was at that moment that I kind of knew the man upstairs was calling in his marker, you know. And I said, okay, this is what I've got to do. I've got to do this, and I've got to try to help people. And that's kind of how I became involved with that, and that is basically what those two organizations do. From that has spawned now the Ton Mastery Foundation, and Ton Mastery was a legendary heavy metal broadcaster here in Los Angeles for years on one of the most famed metal stations during the 80s and 90s, KNAC. And she went on to work for like Westwood One and several other famous stations, as well as Sirius Satellite, where she was the host of Hair Nation. And I worked with her in my life back in the early 90s in radio, and because I used to be a broadcaster in FM radio. And she was always there to help me. And she was a very, very big name at that time, and just gigantic when you, you know, when I look back at it now. And she was so kind to me back then in helping me with my career. Then all these years go by, and I hadn't talked to her since about 94. And I got a call from my good friend from Dio, Rudy Sarzo, who now, you know, used to play with Ozzy and Whitesnake and Quiet Riot, yeah. Now plays with Ronnie James Dio. And he told me, he said, Robbie, do you remember Ton Mastery? I was like, well, of course I do. I used to work with her. He said, she's going through the same thing you went through. And I was like, oh, no. And he said, yeah, and it doesn't look good. So she didn't make it, and she passed away October 2nd of 2007. And her sister, Kara, who is a phenomenal singer, decided to go ahead and make it her mission in life to take Ton's dying wish was to create something that would spread the word in the rock and roll community and around the world in general. But to start off with her friends in the rock and roll community, to let, you know, to change this world when it comes to hepatitis C, and to try to stamp it out. And I've become a very, very big part of that. I've been become a close personal friend of Kara's now, as I was with Ton. And it's just something that, you know, every day it seems like something comes back to me whether it be a friend calling or somebody's friend calling me because they heard my story saying, you know what, I've just been diagnosed with hepatitis C, what do I do? And, you know, like I said, if that's why I'm still here, I'm more than happy to help because, you know, you rarely do you get a second shot at life, and then rarely do you get one that turns out as good as mine has. The chance to go back and recreate and now live the dream again of, you know, creating a band that is now finding some success and moving forward with my life and being here for my wife and daughter. You know, not many people can say that, and for me to be able to have that opportunity has just been great. So if I can give back in any way, that's what I'm trying to do.
I wonder, do you feel more appreciative of everything life has to offer since receiving your transplant, and how much living to the fullest extent means to you? In other words, in what ways has this near-death experience changed you, changed your life?
It's changed me completely. I mean, I used to take, like everybody basically does, every day for granted. You know, you wake up in the morning and you think, you know, you don't really think that, you know what, tomorrow or today might be my last day on this planet. And, you know, when they first told me I had the disease, I was so scared. I mean, literally the point where you're shaking all the time, you're waking up in the middle of the night crying because you think you're going to die tomorrow. You don't want to have to leave your loved ones. You've got so much still left to do in your life, you know. And all of that, when you have to go through that, and then you actually do die on the table a couple times, and they have to fight to bring you back, it does definitely change your outlook on life. Every day, not a day goes by where I don't think about the donor, number one, and how giving she was. I found out it was a woman. I don't know who she is, but I did find that out. And, you know, for her to be so with it that she donated her organs to help save lives, I am so grateful. There's, you know, I've even written a very long letter to the family. You're able to do that once you've had a transplant. You never know who they are. The laws won't allow that. And I wanted to meet that family. I wanted to actually have them donate Life Rocks. I was going to fly them out to the concert that I did with Metal Knights a couple years back. And the family was all for it, but apparently, you know, the father was still pretty shooken up at the loss of his daughter, which I can totally understand. And he just wasn't ready. And I understood that. And, you know, I think about them all the time. I think about, you know, somebody had to die for me to live. But in that process, you know, my life has gone on, and I've tried to live it to the fullest every day. And some people, like the guys in Metal Knights in the band, look at me. So, you know, I've heard it come out of several of their mouths, like, you know, you are the most driven son of a gun I have ever seen in my life. But you know what? That's because I know now that we don't have all the time in the world. There's stuff that needs to be done, and it needs to be done now. It needs to be done today. And you also have to make sure that you always tell the people around you that what they mean to you. That you love them. Not only maybe your wife or your kid or your husband or your family, but your friends. You know, the people that are important to you. You know, you got to tell them what they mean to you, because you never know what's going to happen. And I realize that now. And the other thing that I've noticed is that I'm really not afraid of death like I used to be. It's not to say that I want to go tomorrow. It's just to say that, you know what, I've been there and I've done that, and I'm really, I for some reason, I'm not terrified of death like I used to be. I used to be absolutely terrified of dying. when I was faced with it. But now it's like, you know what? If it happens, it happens. And I know that there's a reason for it. So it really has changed my outlook on life.
Yeah, I believe that. Okay, well, now let's talk about some happy stuff and some music stuff. In March of 2007, you formed a heavy metal band called Metal Knights, based out of Los Angeles, California. Your sound is very reminiscent of the British metal bands of days past. Can you give us some insight as to how Metal Knights was formed and how it all came together?
Well, yeah, I was very fortunate. I was about 2 weeks out of the hospital from receiving my transplant when I have worked in television and movies as well for several years. And I went to, when I was finally out of the hospital, there was a convention that takes place every year called SIGGRAPH, which is the, it's actually the convention for visual effects and 3D and animation, you know, and all that, those kind of things. And it's quite large, and it was in Los Angeles, and I was still in a wheelchair. I still had to go through physical rehab. I had been in bed for a year. I was atrophied. I couldn't walk. But I knew I had to go to this thing because I had to get busy again. I had to get back to work. And I looked terrible. I had lost all my hair. I was 140 pounds. I was skin and bones and in a wheelchair. And I told my wife, I go, honey, I gotta go to this convention. I gotta get back to work. I gotta do something. And lo and behold, when we went to take our lunch break, I saw Rudy Sarzo walk by. And I went, that can't be Rudy Sarzo. He's like a famous bass player in heavy metal. Why would he be at a visual effects thing? And he walked back by again. And a third time, and he was holding his tray looking for a place to sit. Well, there was one chair left next to me, and you know why there was that one chair there? Because I had my own. I was in a wheelchair. And he walked up, and he said, excuse me, is anybody sitting here? And I looked at him, and I went, Rudy Sarzo? And he said, yeah. And I go, oh my God, what are you doing here? I said, of course, please sit down. And he didn't bat an eye, you know, like, who's this guy that looks like he just got out of a concentration camp, you know, in a wheelchair? It didn't even faze him. And he sat down, and we started talking, you know, he said, you know, do you mind if I ask what happened? And I told him what, you know, I'd just been through. And we talked music, and I told him what a big inspiration he had been to me musically throughout my life, and we just hit it off really great. We spent about an hour together at that lunch, and my wife was there with me and him, and he ended up giving me his card and his phone numbers and his, you know, email and everything, and I couldn't believe it. And he said, you know what, he goes, tomorrow I have to leave for a tour of Russia. He said, so I'm going to be gone for about a month. He said, but when I get back, he goes, I would really like to get together with you and come. And at that time, I was just starting to build my studio. And he said, you know, come down and see what you've got. And I was just like, absolutely. And I still couldn't believe that this was one of my rock and roll heroes, you know, since I was like, I don't know, 17, is there talking to me and wants to get together with me and was very genuinely serious about it. So I actually left there on a high like you wouldn't believe. I felt so great that I had met him. And all of a sudden, a month went by, and I got a phone call, and it was Rudy telling me he was on his way back from, I think, London, and said, when I get back, can we get together? Can I come down to your place? I was like, absolutely. And he asked how I was doing and if I had gotten any better, and I told him, yeah, you know, by then I had gotten out of the wheelchair and I was walking again and doing everything, and I had built the studio. So he came down with his lovely wife, and we had a great dinner here at my house, and we started to build this incredible friendship. And it was really through that inspiration of meeting him that And all of our talks about music and animation and 3D visual effects, that I started to think, you know what? I haven't sang in about 20 years, but I wonder if I still could. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, the opportunity came about where some people that I knew, or actually I didn't know, I knew some of their friends, invited me to a party, and that they were in a band. And one of the guys, the bass player, recognized me from when I was in a band in the 80s in Hollywood, which I couldn't believe, number one. Number two, he remembered the name of the band, and I was just blown away, and he told the rest of the people in the band, this guy can sing, why don't we have him come sit in with us when we play live next? And that's really how it all started. I went, and I hadn't been on stage in 20 years. I got back on stage, and that was all it took. The minute I got back on stage, I found out I could sing again and actually sing better. And that's really what started the whole ball rolling. And then I decided, you know what? Instead of going and singing with these guys and doing it this way, I should put my own thing together, you know? And that's how Metal Nights was born. Music's always been a part of my life. So it was just like the next step was I had to put this something together. And I was lucky enough, when I was in my teens, my parents sent me abroad to study at King's College in Aberdeen, Scotland, where I studied medieval literature and medieval history and Shakespeare. And I studied those three things and became fascinated with medieval history. And I started to think about how to put this band together, and, you know, all of a sudden I started getting these visions of these medieval type setting for the band, and that's really how Metal Nights came about. So ever since then, it's just been nonstop, been working at it, you know, living it 24/7. And you know, we just finished our new album. Things are starting to happen, and we're really looking forward to just continuing to do this, and I'm having a blast doing it, you know.
Hiding from sight.
You were just listening to The Enforcer, the first single that will be released very soon by the band Metal Knights. Don't forget to tune in to Turned On with Tina next week for part two of my special feature presentation with Razor of Metal Knights.